Welcome to the live kickoff of our Briefly Focused series. Today's program is Building Structure and Boundaries for Lasting Focus. I'm Belinda McCauley. I'm the Executive Director of the Beverly Hills Bar Association, and I am so happy to introduce today's speaker, Sina Block. Sina is on a mission to help high-performing professionals and entrepreneurs with ADHD who struggle to manage it all, align, and live productively. She's a certified ADHD coach, business consultant, author, and master facilitator. She's the founder and CEO of SaneSpaces.com and creator of the Time and Space Style Inventory, the first online productivity assessment. Her clients find crystal clear focus and tether to what matters most to them. Overwhelm disappears as clients learn about the neuroscience behind motivation, behavior, and emotional set points. Sina helps clients build neuroplasticity and regain control of their time, priorities, and boundaries. This helps them develop hybrid systems, habits, and routines to support their bullet train brains. Her clients get organized and more productive. Sina, we are so looking forward to learning from you today. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Belinda. It's great to be here. Make sure that I'm projecting the slides appropriately. If you can give me a thumbs up or an A-okay, I'd be appreciative.
You are.
Good. Okay, good, good, good. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. That was a pretty beefy intro, so thank you so much. You can find me at sanespaces.com if you want to follow up at any point in time. But today's presentation is a little bit of neuroscience, some skills, some tips. If you are attending with ADHD, or you have a hunch that you have a diagnosis, one of the things I want to invite you to do is listen for specific things that might really appeal to you or might call out to you. If you are attending just to learn more, or perhaps you work with people with ADHD, or perhaps someone in your family or friends have ADHD, it's important to start to think about it as a lifestyle vitality type of brain-based condition. So hopefully we will scratch the surface. There's a lot to cover with ADHD. So I always want to invite you, if you're interested, for more to reach out. So first of all, just a little thing to start with today. Did you know that ADHD is far more prevalent in the legal profession than in the general adult population? Statistics suggest that there's a higher prevalence of ADHD in lawyers. In fact, 1 in 5 to 1 in 8, 12.5 to 20% of attorneys have been either diagnosed or have a hunch, compared to 1 in 20 or 5%. So today we're really going to focus on high achievers with ADHD. There are many, many people, I'm sure you know and have heard, people like Richard Branson, Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates, Walt Disney, and even Albert Einstein, and I would throw Leonardo da Vinci into the pile as well. This was way before ADHD was a diagnosis, but certainly high achievers of all shapes and sizes have had ADHD. And while many people are high achievers on this list, many of these people may have experienced extreme success in their lives, but also may struggle with the small stuff like the activities of daily living. Just some other statistics. Boys are more diagnosed than girls with ADHD, typically as children, because behaviors sometimes hide in plain sight for girls. Girls and women have been traditionally very underdiagnosed, which is recently you'll see more diagnoses. Most of that is due to girls being diagnosed and professional women, believe it or not. So typically girls' symptoms manifest differently in an academic setting, and it is the later in life diagnosis that many women are coming to find their own diagnosis when trying to diagnose their children. So very interesting impacts for ADHD with your colleagues and with people in a professional capacity. So some objectives today were to equip people with some boundary setting techniques and structured routines so that you can move toward a more work-life dynamic that works for you. We're going to look at an overview of some of the symptoms that impact attorneys, really diagnose a little bit about executive function challenges, and then really dive into how to mitigate stress through establishing boundaries, looking at personal limits, finding your own sense of homeostasis, and then look at why repeatable strategies are important. So ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder characterized by persistent patterns of inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity that can hinder one's ability to function effectively in various settings, including the legal profession. And ADHD has quite a stigma, and it is possible that this is why it's so underdiagnosed. I looked up the term stigma, and it's a noun. There, for a plural, it's stigmas or stigmata. So the stigma is something that is a having gone to prison. It's a particular disgrace associated with a particular circumstance. So it can be a mark. It can be known as even something like a visible characteristic. It's known in medicine as a visible sign or characteristic of a disease. In botany, the part of the flower is known as the stigma, but also it's known in the Catholic religion as stigmata, marks that were left on Jesus's body for the crucifixion. So this idea of being marked or disgraced comes to bear. I just read a headline before we started the webinar today. The headline in the Independent was, "I self-medicated for years until I was finally diagnosed." And she wrote, "For years, I struggled with anxiety, low self-worth, and fatigue. And I used alcohol and abused prescription drugs such as codeine. It wasn't until checking into a rehab nearly 2 years ago that things started to make sense, and an adequate diagnosis led to a much more sustainable life." So know that ADHD hides in plain sight. Many, many people struggle with what I call symptom soup. They live in a way that it's the constant paradox of why are some things really hard and other things are really easy. So just to get started, ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder with persistent patterns of inattention, hyperactivity, impulsivity, and it hinders your ability to function effectively in various settings. ADHD is not a lack of attention, but a lack of inhibiting attention. We're going to go deeply into the neuroscience behind that. It is not correlated with intelligence or IQ. And believe it or not, it's actually not overdiagnosed, which is what everybody says these days, but it's actually becoming more diagnosed because more and more people are seeing how difficult it is. Its impact on attorneys, legal professionals with ADHD may really experience difficulties in concentration, decision-making, managing so many multiple tasks and workload that seems to be relentless. neurotypicals or NTs versus ADHD nervous system differences. Basically, it's primarily a nervous system condition where neurotypicals can prioritize based on importance, rewards, and consequences. People with ADHD have an interest-based nervous system. And so they tend to prioritize based on urgency, interest, novelty, and challenge. And this is what makes contextual decision-making and contextual vocations difficult. That's why it's really important when you think about large caseloads or potential miscommunication or emotional dysregulation. It's important to keep in mind that this is a neurological change and difference. And that's why I like to approach this from what is the neuroscience? What do we know about the neuroscience? An ADHD brain doesn't feel deficient. In fact, it's very efficient in many, many things. Context is the most important thing. And that's this web-like awareness of all the things that come to bear when you're in an environment. So it can very often lead to stress and burnout. And one of the things that I'm really committed to is helping people understand themselves better so that they can exhibit agency, freedom, and power in their daily living. So with that side, One of the famous quotes, Dr. Ned Hollowell is famously quoted when explaining ADHD to a child. He'll say, "You have a turbocharged mind like a Ferrari engine, but the brakes of a bicycle." And coaching and therapy can help find your brakes. When it's properly treated, ADHD can really turn distractibility and harness curiosity. So what makes it hard? Well, let's take a look at your different brain modes. There are, according to Andrew Huberman, he's a PhD. He has a podcast called Huberman Lab. You can find him at hubermanlab.com, but he's a neuroscientist and tenured professor for the Department of Neurobiology at Stanford School of Medicine. And I follow him quite a lot. He's got really great content, long form content, but I'm very interested in the neuroscience behind a lot of things. So basically he talks about our brain having two major forms of focus. So he talks about a spotlight and then a fill light. And there are two main types of networks in your brain. One is the default mode network, which includes your dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, your posterior cingulate cortex, and your lateral parietal lobe. A neurotypical brain can have the default mode, attentional mode, and salience mode kind of working together. However, if you have clinical or subclinical ADHD, or believe it or not, when you're sleep deprived, your default mode network is not synchronized with your attentional mode network. These are areas are not, they don't work well together. And so the task positive or attentional mode network is a different part of the brain, and it works in concert with the default mode to suppress your impulses that constantly course through your brain. This makes it hard for people with ADHD, the part of the brain that we need to train or help behave or help you wait your turn. All of those are examples of suppressing default mode, where you'll find deeply rooted in your brain, where we know autopilot is fight, flight, freeze. When you're in a highly emotional state or highly dysregulated state, it's very difficult to access attentional mode, task positive network, and even more difficult to access your curiosity or your salience mode, your learning network. So we're going to look at this in terms of these scientific realities and talk a little bit more about how, starting with just a self-assessment. Let's pull up the poll, if you will, Susie. When we look at ADHD, there are different areas that can be really difficult. So I'm going to ask you, if you're in the room, to please weigh in. What's hard? What is the most difficult thing for you? Activation, getting started, focus, you know, diminishing everything else and focusing on one thing. Effort, like just staying with it, keeping going. Regulating, this is, you know, emotional. Or is memory, maybe remembering to do things, or is it difficult for you to take action? I'm asking you to answer this almost universally. So let's give you a countdown of 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and let's see what we see. What are the results? Very good. Okay. So activation, 41%, struggle, focus, 26%. Effort, interesting, staying with it. Emotional dysregulation or emotional regulation is not showing up as a poll answer, which is interesting. Memory and action, good. So see that all of these things really are difficult for many people with ADHD, but activation, that getting started piece, tends to be a struggle for everyone. So let's talk about why it's hard. Your brain, this is another thing I stole from Huberman. Your brain actively tries to do 5 things at the same time, all day, every day, except when you're sleeping. Your brain is organized in a top-down format, basically to prioritize your survival, your safety and survival. And I use the hand metaphor often in a coaching context because it's helpful to remember this. But at any moment, your brain is managing input from your sensory, format, senses, taste, touch, whatever, your perceptions, what you perceive to be happening, your emotions, how you're feeling about certain things, and your thinking bubbles, what your narratives are. And all of this is prioritized before you can choose. So it's no wonder that activation is one of the most critical differences, because in order for your brain to actually choose, you must inhibit all those four really important inputs. So, interestingly, this is why in the legal profession, traits can be very difficult. Traits can be difficult to manage: impulsivity, managing interruptions. It shows up as time management issues, distractibility. Sometimes people get so focused on things that they lose track of time, often, especially in deep work. It causes people to be very deadline driven, and it can make long-term goals very difficult to engage with. These challenges can significantly impact you and your work and your output. And attorneys with ADHD often face unique obstacles within this because of, you know, large caseloads, potential miscommunication, fast-paced environment, deadlines, overworking, stress, and burnout. All these things really, really matter. So yes, it's a problem. And more importantly, what we have to do again is step out of symptom soup and move into why, what's going on. And so I want to show you the many different executive functions that can be impaired with ADHD. And so take a moment to look at all of these areas. I'm going to start at the top, 12 o'clock, impulse control, thinking before acting. Emotional control, keeping your feelings in check. Flexible thinking, adjusting your behavior according to unexpected change. Organization, keeping track of things physically, personally, mentally, time-wise. Working memory, keeping information in mind to use later. Task initiation, getting started, taking the actual action, and focusing on new tasks. Self-monitoring, self-awareness, perception into how you're doing in the moment, and planning and prioritizing how to set and meet goals. So the ramifications of executive dysfunction can manifest in decreased productivity, missed deadlines, constantly feeling behind, quality of work, it can even jeopardize career. One of the attorneys that I work with works on a split schedule and a kind of truncated schedule because he has found that he works better in a 4-day work week and you know has limited his hours as a result because of his struggles. Real world examples highlight how difficult it is to structure your workflow and how difficult it is to manage dysfunction in these areas. Okay. So one more way to look at those executive functioning skills that we polled on: activation. This is where organizing, prioritizing, activating, focus, sustaining attention, and shifting, switch tasking, effort, regulating alertness, sustaining that effort, processing speed, emotion, managing those frustrations and staying within your window of tolerance. Memory, utilizing your working memory and recalling things when you need to. And then action, monitoring, regulating, and taking action. All right, why is this so hard? Well, because so many parts of your brain are involved in these aspects. So for instance, your brain is doing multiple things on multiple levels at any given time. When you look at the brain-based condition of ADHD and dysregulation, your choosing starts in the amygdala, in the kind of the base of the brain. And in order to find what you need to do, it moves out. So you choose toward the reward. Deciding is also a front-to-back kind of idea. Planning is a front-to-back. I have to sit down and think about it, and then I have to check in with myself. Persistence. It, you know, allowing yourself to access your network, to stay attentive and sustain your attention, distractions are very difficult. Moving and thinking effectively. Notice that all of these areas in your brain are constantly regulating each other and working together between your prefrontal cortex, your striatum, your basal ganglia, your cerebellum. All of these areas need to work together. And in order for you to really do the deeper work and access higher cognitive function, your brain must inhibit first. It has to shut down unimportant, nonsensical behavior. And now, you know, a lot of times ADHD brains struggle with this function. And that's why when we talk about how to get better at brain functioning with ADHD, we must have a conversation about establishing boundaries. So in this segment, we are going to take a look at boundaries and their important role as safeguards to create mental space with ADHD in the legal practice. Okay, I just want to check in. Are there any questions before I move into this next segment? Check. Chat.
Okay. Yes, it looks like we actually have a couple questions. Let's see. The first one. Was one individual asking, why is there a higher prevalence of ADHD in lawyers? Do we know why? What was happening there?
I don't know if it's a why-based answer, but we do know that more attorneys that are, more people who are attorneys have ADHD. I don't know whether it's chicken or egg, you know, nature nurture.
And another person is asking about if people can develop it in adulthood. That sounds interesting, though I haven't heard anything about that. Have you heard anything?
Not statistically. So what happens in adulthood is, especially with high performers, when you move out, especially with people who are in professional capacities, who stay in the academic model for a long time, when you have that rigorous structure and the rewards and challenges and chunked out levels of performance and, you know, all of that structure that's externalized in the academic mindset, when that falls away, a lot of people who are high performers in that highly structured approach struggle because all that stuff is missing. There's no rewards, there's no goals, there's no grades, there's no one to please, there's no people who are telling you how to do it and what to do. It often will happen later in life because people now have to pile on all the things and make all these decisions which are highly complex. So it's not that you can develop it, but if you're a very high performer, it's very possible that you just were not aware of it because a lot of structure lived in your life. Also, you know, I have two high performing sons. One is working on his doctorate and one is going back to get his MBA, but I was their executive functioner for a long time when they were kids. And so when they moved out into their, you know, into their lives, things started to really get more complicated for them. So oftentimes if you live, you know, in an environment where the structure is provided, it can mask symptoms, especially if you're a high performer. What else?
That's it for questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, so let's look at these boundaries. So what is a boundary? We're going to move right on. A boundary is a self-determined guideline, rule, or limit. Personal boundaries are based on what I determine to be reasonable, safe, permissible behaviors for myself, but also for others. And they also have to do with how I respond when my limits are breached. And so this is when I used to teach in person, when I used to do training classes, I would like get really, really close to a participant and they'd get super uncomfortable. And of course it was intended to show we all have boundaries. Some of them are physical, some of them are other ways, but there are eight different areas where they matter. Emotional boundaries refer to feelings. They include limitations on what to share and when to share and with whom to share. Gradually sharing personal information and emotions is usually more, you know, context-based and more relationship-based, but that people can get in trouble there. And Physical boundaries are the personal space issue, physical touch, sometimes inappropriate physical touch or close talkers. People who will invade your physical space might do things like, rummage through your stuff or go through your drawers at the office or something that can be a physical boundary breach. One of the things that annoys the heck out of me is sometimes some trendy kind of restaurants where the server will come and like squat down at your table and like that bugs the crap out of me. So there's like that physical boundary of like, yeah, you can stand up and just take my order. Time is a boundary. How people use their time and how whether or not we set time up or whether we give time away, whether other people ask us for our time. And time, of course, goes through all things like work, relationships, hobbies. Often a time boundary is violated when work or hobbies or other things go beyond what we would consider to be reasonable. A sexual boundary is physical aspects, and they could be also emotional and intellectual aspects. We want to respect limitations and desires with sexual partners, inappropriate touch, physical pressure to engage in certain sexual activities or leering and so forth. That's an example of a sexual boundary. Financial and material boundaries. For instance, think things like, do you lend money to people? Do you lend money to your siblings or people in your family? That can be something difficult. Can somebody steal something from you? Is that a possession that matters to you? An intellectual boundary, it usually has to do with respecting someone's ideas or discussion, an awareness of when you violate someone's ideas or thoughts or belittle or invisibilize maybe what a person is thinking or contributing to a conversation. Spiritual, religious, beliefs, practices, holidays, celebrations. Again, dismissal or invisibilizing of others will show up as a boundary breach. And then, I always encourage people to think about what are your non-negotiables? What are things that, that are really things that you don't want to compromise on? And often those are boundary conversations that need to be had, especially in certain situations and often even with work. All right. Why boundaries are difficult? While ADHD is challenging, it's challenging on so many different levels, but when you're thinking about any impulse, opportunity, or circumstance, executive dysfunction matters. Any impulse, any opportunity, any circumstance can have a fuzzy outcome. It can have distractions that will come up. Emotional dysregulation or temper can come up. Boundaries matter with your sense of adaptability, and that the areas in the green boxes are symptomatic of underfunctioning executive functions. So if you struggle with accountability, if you struggle with resentment or rejection sensitive dysphoria, boundaries will come to play, and often the work to be done is work on your boundaries. Okay. So let's talk about the different types. From a psychology standpoint, you're going to see these three, they kind of fall into three groupings. One is enmeshed boundaries, where, I can't tell the difference between you and me. Another is healthy boundaries. We all kind of strive for healthy boundaries where I get to be me and you get to be you, and we get to discuss what we each need and want. And then there are rigid boundaries, and rigid boundaries, they show up in real life. And we're going to dig down just a little bit further. You see the boundary types, me and you, this kind of cross-pollination of self. If you grew up in a situation where you really weren't allowed to recognize your own boundaries, you may struggle with the things on that bulleted list. Weak boundaries, hard to say no. You might be passive and agreeable even when you don't want to be. You might be call yourself a people pleaser. You may overshare. You may really fear rejection or have this weak identity or really crave external validation. That would be an example of enmeshed boundaries. And the work to be done there is to really move more toward the middle, where you can establish firmness, but be flexible. You can say no without guilt. You really can learn more about what your needs are and learn how to express them respectfully in a way that helps you be clear and helps others know where you stand and where you start. Healthy boundaries usually come with a strong sense of self and usually show up in relationships that are adult-adult. And then we have the example of rigid boundaries. And some people develop very, very rigid ways of interacting with the world. They can be closed off. They can have difficulty in trusting. They can be real control freaks and be inflexible. They may cut people out and, you know, you did this and I'm no longer your friend, or you're no longer a part of my family. Often they can feel misunderstood and alone. Relationships can feel surface when you have very, very rigid boundaries, very much as a result of being reluctant to be vulnerable because of the fear of vulnerability. Things must be done your way. So boundaries also are often expressed as either passive, assertive, or aggressive. So take a minute to look at this. This is like the passive boundaries, you're focused on others. It's kind of like the enmeshment. Aggressive boundaries, you're kind of focused on yourself and meeting your own needs. Assertive boundaries take into account both sides. And, you know, we've all lived long enough to know that we all express our boundaries differently. Now, what's important to understand is nature, babies are born assertive. Babies are able to meet their needs by expressing them but through crying. And they cry if they feel insecure or if their environment is not right or they have a wet diaper or they need to have food, and they express their needs and they're either met by a caregiver or not. And this is where we start looking at how deeply rooted boundary breaches and boundary difficulties are, because a baby will adapt their behavior based on the response they get from the environment or the situation. You know, if your family approached conflict by screaming at each other and arguing, then you may have dealt with conflict very differently than somebody who grew up in a family that was never allowed to have conflict, or conflicts were swept under the rug or avoided. If your family believed in meeting their, if your parents believed in meeting their own needs above yours, then you may find it challenging to even assert your needs because you don't even know what they are. So what happens in adulthood is these once adaptive behaviors for a child in an environment where their needs were, they need to do things to get their needs met, become maladaptive as an adult. So as an adult, it can be tricky to express your needs. And that's where we get this passive aggressive thing. Oh, it's fine. I didn't really want to do that anyway. This passive aggressive means that you behave quietly or passively and don't really address breaches or conflicts directly, but somehow maintain control by getting back at a situation. So this can go into a full-blown conversation, but the fact of the matter is we need to assert boundaries by deciding what we want, deciding whether it's fair, and then clearly making requests and regulating our behavior. And these are skills to learn. These are communication skills and relationship skills that you can learn. In fact, much of therapy and relationship therapy is about this particular area that is difficult. Boundaries, when you start building them and really digging into your own, can help you practice self-care. They can help you put yourself first. They can really help you understand what your universal needs are and communicate about those. They can help you find focus and create work bouts where you say, no, I'm not going to be interrupted, help you make decisions, and help set respectful limits. You know, this little video is, I draw the line at pineapple pizza. Brené Brown, with her book Dare to Lead, talks about being clear. She struggled a lot with kind of passive aggressive boundaries with her team and has come up with like a new mantra, which is clear is kind. If you can get to your needs and your bottom line, it can be very helpful for you to manage your stress in your work, because when you put yourself first, it's much easier to build on top of a strong sense of self. So at this moment in our webinar, it would be helpful to just think about your boundary struggles. Like, pick one. We've looked at a lot. Pick one area this week that might be helpful for you to focus in on. And you can use any of the distinctions and categories that I've provided, or you can use where you're feeling that maybe you're being passive or maladaptive in some of your own boundaries, because this work is deep, and this is excellent work to bring into a coaching context, because we can revisit it and work on it over time. But where are you struggling? Pick one to work on this week. And I'm not opening up to discussion, because a lot of this is very, very personal, but let's take a minute just to think about this. Are there any questions?
There are currently no questions.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, so we're going to move on to the second segment here. How do we set personal limits? Well, we're going to start thinking about establishing safeguards and the mental space you need to focus and help yourself in your work. And let's begin with a little adaptation of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. This chart should look familiar for most of you if you know anything about the behavioral scientist Maslow. And this was adapted by one of my mentor coaches, Cameron Gott. You can find him at CameronGott.com. But he actually took that, you know, basic physiological needs, and he stuck in there ADHD awareness. Because when we are aware of our needs through the ADHD context and through the ADHD lens, our whole life changes. We go from having, you know, nice to have identity of work or play or exercise, and we put that at the bottom of the triangle. Meaning, when I learn more about my own needs and my own idiosyncrasies, I can work well from the bottom up. I can find my sense of safety and my sense of how I manage my daily stress. I can work on those safety needs, like finances and obligations and commitments. And then I can move into the belonging areas, where I can create positive connections and supportive interactions and relationships with other people. Again, this is where boundaries will show up when you engage with other people often. Then you can work on higher things like your esteem, your self-esteem, and creative action and making a difference and giving back. And of course, self-actualization comes from sharing your bigger positive impact. But I think it's important to think about, when you look at this, to look at it through an ADHD lens if you have ADHD, because without awareness of who you are, how you are, and how your brain works, you're constantly adapting to a neurotypical world and making it very difficult on yourself to find your own sense of homeostasis. So again, we're going to revisit the hand, right, with a sensing, perceiving, emoting, thinking, and doing. And now we're going to talk about how hard this is as an input to inhibit with ADHD. How to set personal limits has a lot to do with how you manage your environment, and with the most important piece being your sensory input. Now, a lot of people with ADHD also have, they call themselves HSPs, highly sensitive people, meaning they are constantly filtering out heavy sensory input. So think about it. An example of this model to keep it in mind is, when you smell smoke, you may perceive danger, you may feel afraid, you may think What's burning? And then you may just go and figure it out, right? Or you feel something hot with your hand, you immediately move your hand, right? That sensory input is the most dominant because it's most related to survival. If you fall underwater and can't swim, your sensory input is going to help you get to the top of the water. So understand that this is the this prefrontal cortex job of inhibition must help you inhibit external non-useful information. And this is why it's hard, because when we think about the environmental impacts of your senses, your sight, your field of view, clutter, piles, your horizon, can I see the horizon? My visual input is my strongest sense. So how are you doing with managing your field of view? Is this clutter? Is it difficult? Is it dysregulating? How about sound? Does loudness matter? Do you have people who interrupt you? Chatter, background noise, ambiance? Do you have headphones? Do you go into perhaps you go into a busy location like a coffee shop because other people are busy, but you can tune it out. Like, how does that environment impact you? Smell, sense, food, coffee, aromas, mold. Do those things impact your environment? Are you working at home? Are you working in an environment or an office? Touch, texture, pressure. I changed my clothes twice. I had a sweater on earlier that was scratchy. I hated it. Like, texture, does that touch anything from your sensory input in that way? Does it matter to you? Does it dysregulate you? How does it impact you? Taste. Some people have, you know, water, chewing. How about certain glasses or certain pens in terms of touch? Like, I have clients who constantly have little rituals around these sensory inputs. Proprioception, this is the awareness of your body in space. A lot of people with ADHD, especially as youngsters, they fell down a lot. They run into things. Even as adults, they are not having the awareness at the same time of their body in space. Vestibular balance. This is what I say, which is what's so difficult with ADHD, is that this all lives here. That's a lot to inhibit, to get all the way down that ladder and down to doing. And so if you have areas in your life that you need to set personal boundaries around, consider your senses. Do you support yourself, or are you dysregulated often? And maybe your office is a wreck. And if it's a wreck, maybe taking a day to get it together will actually have a huge long-term impact on how you feel about work and stress. Because what we're all trying to do is stay within what we call a window of tolerance, where I can show up and I can feel comfortable, in control, and in my optimal state in this green area, okay? And your window of tolerance is when you are available, aware, alert. You're not anxious. You can engage with your environment. You can engage with your work, right? Our job in coaching and often in therapy is to expand that window of tolerance. And what happens is when we have these sensory inputs, we become dysregulated. We can start to feel irritable or anxious or agitated or uncomfortable. And we're moving toward hyper arousal. Right? That's where dysregulation lives. That's where rejection sensitivity lives. And other nasty things up in that red zone: panic, heart rate, outbursts, poor concentration. Or we may dysregulate toward the freeze zone, which we might be starting to shut down or feeling uncomfortable, starting to distract ourselves, zoning out, numbing out, losing track of time. Or we might slip into hypoarousal, poor digestion, depression, shutdown, checked out, detached, low energy, flat, unavailable. This chart is so useful when you think about orienting and doing a systems check, like, where am I? How am I feeling here? Am I in my window of tolerance, or am I dysregulated? And if I'm dysregulated, what do I need to do right now to drop into my body and help myself? So reflect on your environment and your sensory input. How can you manage your environment to manage your sight, sound, smell, touch, taste, proprioception, and vestibular limits. Because setting limits is important to creating an environment that helps you work. Okay, I'm going to move ahead because we're getting low on time here and we've got two more segments. So one of the things that everybody always comes into coaching to talk about is, I just want to have a balanced life. I just want to have work-life balance. And I kind of hate that term, mostly because balance is not a place to go. Balance is something that you're constantly working on. It's a constant adjustment. And I normally will have people like stand up and then lift one leg and then they balance and they feel like this constant adjustment in their weight or in their personal self. So balance is not really a place to go. It's a dance. It's a way of adapting to your environment. So I like to use the term homeostasis. What makes you feel good? What makes you feel available? And we can't do that unless we take a look at the universal needs. This is some information from the Centers for Nonviolent Communication. You can find them at cnvc.org. But the fundamental concepts of universal needs needs are the conditions that every human being has in order to thrive. And they include the physical needs, like the stuff that we saw in Maslow's hierarchy, water, air, food, but also intangible ones like respect and meaningful work and empathy and understanding and dignity. But because these are considered universal, we have to know our needs because, one of the things I'm trained to do as a coach is to listen for when people become dysregulated because their needs are not being met. Like it's almost universal. When our needs are not met, we must first understand what the need is in order to meet it. And so when you think about your own needs for transcendence, starting at 12 o'clock, rest, empathy, community, safety, sustenance, work, honesty, autonomy, and challenge. When we are meeting our needs, we will have a much harder time with anything that has to do with getting work done. So how do you meet your needs and set your boundaries? Well, take some time to look at that chart and look at each one of those areas and ask yourself, where are my non-negotiables? Where are my triggers? Pause and slow down. You can start small to meet your needs. Some of my clients, when they get completely anxious and dysregulated, one of my attorneys, she sometimes will come and she's like, I can't even think at this stage. We do this exercise called pointing and naming, literally, computer screen, water bottle, keyboard, mouse. It's a regulation strategy to get into present moment awareness, like pause, slow down, start small, point and name. Practice meeting your needs. And think about your needs being the bottom of that Maslow's hierarchy, physiological, sense, spells out sense, sleep, exercise, nutrition, systems, workflows, and your environment. All right, any questions now?
It looks like that is about it for now.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, so I'm gonna revisit the hand model one more time because I'm gonna introduce one more piece, which is how do I get things done? In order for your algorithmic pattern-making machine, your brain, to choose what to do, it has to inhibit all extraneous information, and your prefrontal cortex wants to do three things. It needs to run an algorithm for how long is this task going to take me? Duration. What are my steps that I have to take? Path. And when can this be done? When can I put it down and walk away? So your brain is a brilliant machine. It's always trying to get the day off. It requires the most calories to run. And so your brain will constantly create patterns of behavior to make things easier. It's the pattern making machine is what makes it possible for you to kind of get up in the middle of the night, use the bathroom in the dark, and not have to flip on all the lights and know where everything is. Because your brain has made a pattern of how you get from your bed to your bathroom and, whatever. You don't need the lights on. You don't need that extra input, that extra sensory input, because you have a pattern in your brain. Okay, so in order to get started, your brain needs to predict these three things. Duration, how long is this going to take? In other words, when can I quit? When is my coffee break, right? Path, define the steps to start. And outcome, what is the actual task? Now, when I work with clients with ADHD, I always say, let's start with outcome, even though most people want to start with how long they have. What I like to start to train people to do is say, what is it that you're doing? Like someone will say, oh, I have such a problem with time management and it's email. And I say, what's the outcome of email? And people are like, ah. And so we often will talk about really starting to slice and dice your tasks down to this level. What is the outcome you're looking for here? How long do you have, or how long is it going to take, and what are the steps to finish? And this is like a golden formula for ADHD to help you regulate and get started, especially for so many of you who struggle with activation. When you look at your task list, most of us just have triggers of things that we have to think about, or client name, or folder, or things like email. But if you can start to train yourself to say, what do I need to do? And get more granular, you can start to work this DPO model on your task list and see if it's more helpful. Okay. So, how to use your personal boundaries to start setting up specific ways to help yourself. Externalize those boundaries. Let people know. Identify your non-negotiables. Write down the commitments that you have to tasks, and write them down so they are externalized out of your brain. Learn to verbalize what you need and what you want. Calendar management is a big, big thing. We're going to work on that on the second seminar that I'm going to come back and talk about. But we'll talk about actual specifics of how to do these things. Set aside work bouts. Your brain needs to call forward deeper work by creating that algorithm of predicting how long things are going to take and how to do them and when you're going to be done. So when you time block and you create a work bout, you can expect discomfort, and you can expect it to take 6 to 9 minutes of discomfort before you drop in. If you're a person who has trained yourself to distract yourself or go online or do shopping or look at something else, or God forbid, pull up the news, all of that is a pattern that is not allowing you to sit in the discomfort of flipping that switch from default mode to attentional mode. It's a threshold that you must pass, and it's uncomfortable. So by setting out calendared time to work and figuring out what you're going to do using the duration, path, and outcome formula, it can be very helpful. One thing that we also work on with a lot of my clients is, like, I'll give them a field work of the week to say no to everything. And it's not very popular, but it is really helpful, because if you are a person who's a people pleaser or a yes person, this is a huge critical point of failure for you. You need to work on no and being comfortable with no and disappointing other people. No is a complete sentence. It's effective. You can try it. You can use it, see what happens. But what you really want to do is stop saying yes. And so no will work. Or you can say something like, I'm not sure about that. Let me check. I'll get back to you next week, or whatever. Like, slow down your yes. This will very, very much help you if you struggle with being overcommitted and really struggle with it. Slow it down. Let somebody earn your yes. Okay, and we're going to move into the final segment in this last part of our session here. How do you build repeatable strategies? Well, we looked at a lot of neuroscience. Your brain is a pattern recognition machine. You create patterns all through your world. You know how to make your coffee in the morning. You know how to get yourself dressed. You know how to take your shower. You know how to do all kinds of, you know how to get into a car and move from place to place. Your brain has created patterns for almost everything that you do. It's when things are new that your brain slows down and says, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. Help me out here. I don't have a pattern I can recall to come back to. So this is the neuroscience that we use to build your own repeatable strategies. Because at the end of the day, it just matters where you take action and where you do not take action. I mean, this is really motivation is about yes, I'm going to do this, or no, I'm not. And so if you think about it that cleanly, here are some strategies to help you understand ADHD. The game of ADHD and living well with ADHD is about regulating your nervous system, period. If you become a master at regulating yourself and finding your sense of homeostasis, your life with ADHD is going to be a lot more successful and a lot more fulfilling. Nervous system regulation is in charge. So developing these self-regulation rituals to stay within your window of tolerance is where you want to go. And again, this is transformative work. This is work over time. This is not, oh, let me just do my checklist this way. It's one of the classic things that coaches talk about behind the scenes. You know, you get the client that comes, I just need some tips and tricks. Well, that's not going to work. What's going to work is you learning more about yourself and figuring out what you need and how to regulate in your own time, in your vocation, in your professional and personal spaces around time, tasks, commitments, exercise, health, relationships, family, all of these areas need patterns. And when you start with your non-negotiables, start with this inside-out format, you can develop a startup routine in the morning. You can develop a wind-down routine or a rest or reset routine and regulation routines. This is where they begin. Build a ladder out of overwhelm. Overwhelm is an anxious nervous system state. You're already out of your window of tolerance when you're in overwhelm. Your nervous system, your heart rate, your breathing, your movement, it's already in dysregulated state. So you have to build a physical ladder out of it. And the easiest way to do that is to drop into your body. Whether you have a huge caseload, you need to learn to stop and pivot. Stop and pivot. Even if it's just pivoting your field of vision from your screen to the horizon, those somatic changes are connected to your brain, and they will help you if you learn to not empower the overwhelm, but learn that the overwhelm is a signal that you need to shift, that you need to pivot. Reduce your distractions. Look at those areas in your environment that are dysregulated and focus on essential tasks. Use honesty as a tool. Honesty is the one thing that helps you be clear and help you set your boundaries in the most efficient way. Harnessing and organizing for productivity. Structured environments will help you. They have to be your structure, though. They can't be mimicked from somebody else. They will help with predictability, reliability. When you have a structure, you have more consistency, you have a pattern. And so they help you enhance focus, reduce your noise and anxiety, and cut out overwhelm. Overwhelm is a signal that you need to do something different. Just understand that. You can't live there. You can't live there. Daily routines, startup, closeout, performance patterns help you prioritize, estimate time, reduce redundancy. I mean, build redundancy so things are easier, reduce cognitive load. Help you switch tasks and support your working memory. Externalize your tasks. You can try different techniques to see if they work. Pomodoro technique, body doubling. A lot of people use FocusMate as a body doubling app for work bouts with it. You know, when they have to do work that they don't like to do, you can tap into FocusMate and you can meet with somebody across the world at 10 o'clock on Friday morning because that's when you got to do your report. And you sit down and they come in from Australia and they're going to do their thing. And FocusMate's a really good body doubling app if you like the body doubling approach. You can also invest or check out all the blocking apps and productivity apps. There are hundreds of them. be careful because tools and apps, you have to understand what works best for you. Are you a digitally organized person or a physical organized person? Or do you need to have some kind of hybrid approach? You need your system to help you look daily, weekly, monthly, and long term, your time horizon. You need a capturing system. Understand that email is not a task, it's actually just a communication portal. So you have to harvest the tasks out of email, and that's a process. Distinguishing tasks from projects, from maintenance. Organize yourself enough. There's no critical place to be. You just have to know where things are, know what you have, know what you need, and know where to find it. And anything you can repeat, you can build a workflow for. So we're just rolling over the hour here. I know we have a little bit more time, if that's okay. Can we keep going a couple more minutes?
Yeah, of course. We actually also have a couple more questions, but
Okay,
if
great.
you'd like to, I have a couple here. Daniel Grover here is asking about the dreaded P word of procrastination. So how would you say that applies to, activation, or what would you suggest for some tips to, I guess, or struggle with procrastination?
So procrastination is another one of those difficult words, because I would say, Daniel, to go back here and think about what we want to harvest. We want to look at the behavior curiously. What are you getting from procrastinating? What is it delivering? And I don't know whether you can unmute yourself or not, but procrastinating is typically a dysregulation of, so really clearly identifying what you need to do in this way can help. Procrastination is often a pattern that is a behavioral approach to not differentiating what the outcomes are and not being aware of what you need to do. But it also could mean that you need rest. It could mean that you're completely uninterested in the task at hand. It could be masking as some other coping strategy. So if you struggle with procrastination, we've got to get curious about it. What are you getting from it? Because procrastination is a tool. Are you getting that you don't have to avoid punishment? Are you getting to avoid doing the boring thing? What is procrastination doing? And then we would work together to say, what are you actually doing? What is the performance that you're engaging in when you procrastinate? And what need does that fill? Do you see, it's not a tips and tricks thing. It's going to be dependent on what are you doing? And what is that delivering for you in terms of meeting your needs? What are you not doing? And what are the consequences? And then what are you willing to do to pivot? Procrastination is often a maladaptive pattern. And if it's not working for you, we've got to get curious about what it is delivering and where the missing pieces are. Which of your executive functions that you need access are hard? Which ones are unsupported? Which ones do you need to focus in on? Procrastination as a pattern, as a maladaptive pattern, means that your brain is finding whatever you're doing easier than the thing you have to do. How's that?
That's great. It also looks like we have a couple questions. It looks like activation is a struggle here. One person, Ashley, is asking, how do we even find the time to develop these routines and structures?
People do it in many, many different ways. What I would say is, if you're feeling like you don't have the time to do it, is to actually just gather data on what you already do. And what are you already doing that's working? This is a quintessential coaching question. We don't ask why. We ask, what are you doing that's working and what's in the way? And then we try to get very, you know, like surgical about addressing the pieces that are in the way of activation. Some of the immediate pieces are to pause and pivot, like pause and name, pause. Those are some of the first things that we do, because in a coaching context, what we have to do is raise awareness first. What's going wrong? Where are the pain points? And then we gather a lot of data around that in your lived experience. And then we start to work on things in a simple way. And as you start to move into competence with some of this stuff on your own, the layers come. So it's an answer that can only be answered really by you. And I don't mean to wimp out about that, but it's very, very specific to each person. What was the other question?
The other question regarding activation, it looks like, can you give an example of how to start writing something in a legal letter? It's easy, but you can't get your head to start it in the morning. And some reason you can only get your head working in the afternoon or the evening, or when it's a rush deadline.
Great. That's awesome. So I'm telling you that this particular magic formula is really, really helpful. Another thing that I know that several of my clients have done who are attorneys has boilerplates and templates. Somebody I worked with this week was going to create a template as a document that she would put in each client file. And the templates were like the brief and a couple of other things where I'm not an attorney, so I don't have the words, but she created certain boilerplates that were almost all worked out except for the things she had to fill in. And then along the lines when we were working in the session, she's like, I could have my assistant do this. And it was this huge insight that she consistently hits this performance point where it's all the things, right? It's all the executive functions that are breaking down, right? She hits this, oh my God, I got to do a legal brief. Ah, and she's in this space where she's got to manage all these things. And then when we talked about what does a legal brief look like, is there anything that's repeatable in that? And that's when she said, oh yeah, I could create a workflow or a template or a boilerplate. And so think about some of the areas in your work right now that you can granularize in these outcomes that can be repeatable and usable. And again, once you have something, those first steps to start are easier. But remember, there will be discomfort. You're going to have, 6 minutes of discomfort before you start something hard. One other thing that I wanted to add at the end here, which is many of you may be familiar with the book Atomic Habits by James Clear, Creating Habits for Sustainable Change. He talks about this four-step process to cueing, craving, response, and reward. How do you make a habit? Well, you need to make whatever habit it is, make it obvious. Let's say you want to exercise, or you want to walk at the end of your day, making it obvious. Signs, leaving your shoes out, setting out your clothing that you're going to work out with, packing a bag with your pickleball set in it, whatever, make it obvious. Craving, make it attractive. You want to make something you want to do more attractive and make something you don't want to do less attractive, making that harder. Make it easy, and then make it satisfying. The reward piece can be tricky because you don't want to reward yourself for everything, because it will no longer be rewarding if you do it all the time. But this cue, craving, response, reward is how James Clear talks about creating a habit. And of course, habits take time. You have to create behaviors first. From a coaching context, we just work on the behavior first, the pause and the pivot. We don't work on habits until you're really locked in on what you want to do repeatedly to help you regulate. Habits create consistency. And when you have a consistent pattern, it's easier to access. One of the things that happens with a lot of us is that we start something. One of the attorneys I was working with, he said, I went to the gym for 82 days or something like that, and then I stopped. Day 83. And now it's day 84. And this, like, I'm doing it, boom. again, we've got to create a ladder out of that breakdown. It's a breakdown. I didn't do it yesterday. Okay, how about today? Understanding that reminders and getting up and doing it again, you have to get over that discomfort of whatever your story is. I failed or I didn't do it, and try again. Like, it's okay. You can do it again. Habits also are helpful when you have buddies and mutual support, external motivation. Another piece for habits for people is tracking them, like, watches that show us how we sleep and how many steps we have and how what our, heart rate variability is, and all these, and my heart rate and how things, like I can go to my watch and I have a whole track and see, I can go and figure out when my last, my 2.5 mile walk yesterday. The track ability and your ability to track over time is very helpful for your working memory to keep you motivated and keep you moving. Was there another question?
It looks like we have one last question from Nancy Conway asking, could you go over the suggestion to focus on one thing this week?
Look at
Aha.
that. Thank you, Nancy. Yes, I cherry picked a few of them out of my very dense and long presentation. One action I would suggest, if you could pick something from this bulleted list, what will you try this week? Some type of boundary. Pick one. Pick one where you struggle and work on it. Work on expressing it, having somebody earn your yes, saying no, anything around boundaries, physical, environmental, emotional, money, any of them. There's so much there, right? Look at those executive functions. Take a look at the charts that you have as a handout, and sit down and say, where do I run amok? Where do I struggle? What do I need to do to support myself better? This boilerplate template idea might be useful. One action might be to define your personal needs. Look at that universal wheel of needs and see where you're really out of alignment, where you're not meeting your needs. Develop a wind up, a startup, and a wind down routine every day. What's your startup routine? What's your wind down routine? You need 15 minutes. People with ADHD often will shortcut their own attention management strategies because they think they're neurotypical, but everybody has to do them. Everybody does them. How are you managing your days and your time? Like, how do you do it? Sit down and think about a startup routine. How do you put your tasks down and look at your time, look at your appointments that you have, and how do you manage it? How do you engage with it? How do you stay present to it? A startup routine and a wind down routine, first 15 minutes, last 15 minutes of the day, are very, very helpful where you check things off the list or follow up or move things ahead to tomorrow. Understand that, work on that 6 minute threshold for focus. Decide on your calendaring and scheduling. Try DPO on your task list, duration, path, and outcome. Check out some apps or tools. You can try body doubling or doing a couple sessions with a partner or a colleague. Break your tasks into steps. See what it takes to actually break something down into step one, step two. And when we do this in a coaching context, it's crazy because I'll say, well, how will you do that? And someone will say, well, I have to open the database and I have to go to the client file and I have to do this. And I'll do step one, open database, step two, open client file, step three, open template. And then I put it back in chat and they read it and they're like, oh, that's so much easier. If you haven't broken things down into a step-by-step process, that might be really, really useful, really, really helpful. And you can try some time blocking apps where they like shut your phone down and shut notifications down. But those are the one action things that I would look at. Pick one of those and work it. Identify something specific to work on and then get curious about what works. Okay, today we looked at how ADHD impacts an attorney's ability to manage time and tasks. We looked at executive function challenges that are universal to ADHD, but not universal to all people who have ADHD. You may be incredibly great at some and not so great at others, and that's what makes ADHD so tricky. We looked at structures and strategies to help you mitigate stress, boundaries, personal limits, describing your own sense of homeostasis and balance, and building repeatable strategies. We already got to the Q&A, but here are some few resources for you that I mentioned. Chad.org, atomagazine.com. My site is Sane Spaces, Centers for Nonviolent Communication with a Wheel of Needs, and lots of good stuff there, and Atomic Habits. And I'm Sina Block. And I would love to connect with you at any point in time. You're welcome to come to my website, my blog, or connect on LinkedIn is probably the easiest.
Alrighty, that concludes today's presentation. Thank you so much, Sina, for your time, and thank you so much to the viewers today for taking the time out of their day to enjoy watching this program.
Thank you.